welcome you all to the Writing Colloquia. This is a fantastic turnout. I'm thrilled that you are all taking some time in the afternoon on a Wednesday to learn about the art and craft of writing. I'm excited for this whole series for the next 7 weeks. I think we have just a wonderful lineup, wonderful specific and general discussions about writing. I think that'll help you guys immeasurably. So I'd like to just make a few procedural notes. There's a sign-up sheet going around, and this is just actually for academic success for their records. I think the sign-up sheet does not actually have enough slots for all of you, so if you could raise your hand if you actually have the sign-up sheet. Okay, all right, great. We're actually just gonna pass out some more sheets. If you could write your name, your email address, and your ID number on those sheets, so we have a record of the fact that you are here. This academic success has asked us to do that. Yeah. Oh, yeah, Ellie, I think you have extra ones. I think they need some down there. Yeah, the first, Ellie, the first back up here. Okay. All right, well, I'd like to introduce our first speaker. Dr. Kreider is going to be talking to us about caring for the reader's soul. It's Ancient Rhetoric and the Modern Essay. So let's welcome Dr. Kreider.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I wanted to thank Ms. Niebuhr and also Professor Romanek Baldwin for putting the series on. I think it's a great idea to talk about composition. It's also a fairly festive gathering. I think almost all of you are freshmen, which is, this is a fairly large gathering of your class. And just to let you know, the rumor on you guys is actually that you're a pretty good class. We're impressed with you and excited to be working with you. Let me go ahead and get started. I want to use this as an occasion to orient and situate your understanding of composition, which turns out to be such an important part of the core curriculum experience. You do a lot of writing, as you can already tell, and frequently you're moving very, very quickly, and a lot of you, especially at the beginning, will rely on your high school training to get you through the day, right, or the night, or the early morning, whenever you're finishing that essay in order to get it in. And so what I want to do is I want to give you a broad understanding of the activity of writing, and then situate particular skills or arts within that. And so what I'd like to do is to situate your understanding of composition within an ancient tradition, and that is the tradition of rhetoric. And so it goes at least as far back as Homer, right? When Phoenix says to Achilles in Book 9, something you've all now read, he says that your father asked me as your teacher to be a teacher, to make you a doer of deeds, right, and a speaker of words. And the Greek is actually to make you a rhetor, to make you a practitioner of the art of rhetoric. And rhetoric is an ancient study. As you know, it has a bad name, but it's not deserved. One form of rhetoric, of course, is sophistry, which also has a bad name, which it does deserve. And so what I want to do is I actually want to defend rhetoric and suggest that you might think about your compositional activities as practicing this art of rhetoric. The reason that I'm thinking of rhetoric as caring for the reader's soul is that that actually arises out of Plato's definition of rhetoric in the Phaedrus. It's a very different dialogue than the Republic. But in the Phaedrus, he defines rhetoric, he has Socrates define rhetoric as the art of soul leading by means of language. And so the first thing that he's doing is he's identifying the situation you're in when you write as one of one soul, right? The soul of the writer or the speaker leading another soul, which means that the art of writing is a social relationship. You are not writing to a grading machine, right? You're writing to another human being who wants to understand the matter at hand that's being discussed. Nor are you writing as a machine. I mean, we all fight, I think, against a model of productivity that diminishes us as actual persons. But the first thing to point out is under the influence of Plato, we can see quite clearly that the art of rhetoric, including the art of rhetoric during composition, is a way of talking about a human relationship. And in this case, that human relationship is between you and your teacher, yes, but not only. It's also anyone who reads you. So it would be your teacher, it would be tutors in the writing center, it would be your peers, it would be other professors as well. And so what we begin to see is that if we diminish composition to mere technique, we will miss that, in fact, at least according to Plato, it is an art of soul leading. There's a second definition I very much like. This one comes from Aristotle. I'll pull it out with big guns, Plato and Aristotle. And he argues, this one's a little more involved, he argues that rhetoric is the faculty of discovering available means of persuasion. It's a faculty. The Greek here, by the way, is dunamis, the root of dynamic. It's a power of the mind. So what we're dealing with is a faculty or a power of the mind that includes intellect, it includes imagination, it includes spirit. And so it's not reducible to a formula. So in this soul-leading moment, during which you as writer lead the soul of your reader by means of language, you will employ at times formula. But rhetoric is not essentially those formulae. It is the power of the mind to decide which formula in which case would be most helpful, one, and it's also the power to invent formulae. New patterns that haven't even been discovered yet in the art of writing. One of the problems so often for students and for teachers, for all of us, is that we begin to write in formulae that we then just take as, of course, the natural way. Let me give you an example. I just finished, actually I'm not quite finished, those of you who are in my Litred 1 class, but I'm almost finished. Watch for that email. I just finished a set of essays, and I had the same experience, two sets actually, that I have every fall, and that is that a number of you have internalized a particular formula. And by the way, it's not just students in my section. You as a class have internalized a formula. And I know you've internalized it because it's very interesting to watch. Almost, I would say about a third to half of any class will write a particular kind of essay in for their essay one. Anybody think they know what that is? What kind of essay? Let me ask it this way. How many paragraphs do you think most of the essays I've just finished reading have? Five. You sounded like an Athenian chorus. Five. And we all know what that essay looks like. It has a funnel in introduction where you start with the most general, banal thing you can say in the Iliad by Homer. Thank you for that. I forgot. So, first, you just say, don't make fun of us in front of other people. they did it too. Don't worry. And of course, what you do is you have a general statement, you get more and more specific. In fact, there's always a click, a moment of click, where I think, okay, now we're going to get, of course, the thesis or something resembling a thesis. Then we'll get 3 points. Why three? Nobody knows. You were told to give three. Always give three, so you gave three. You might have only had two. So you use the third slot to repeat paragraph one or two in different words, or you just made shit up. By the way, I'm not going to accuse you of anything that I haven't done more often and with less excuse than you. So I know where you live. I've been as bad a student as any of you, trust me. The conclusion, by the way, is just the introduction backwards. So you could write one of these without thinking, which is what makes it so nice, at 2:30 in the morning when you're all hyped up. On caffeine, which is, by the way, a drug. You're all hyped up, you gotta have something, out it comes. Now, that's a formula. That's a formula. That's not the exercise of a human faculty, a power of the mind, to discover means of persuasion that are available to you. And what's interesting here is we're talking about a faculty to discover. In the intellectual world, you are an adventurer. You are a discoverer. Now, what distinguishes this art from other arts would be that you're discovering particular things, means of persuasion. And not just any means of persuasion, the ones that are available to you, which means you need as many means of persuasion as possible so that when you choose, you have a lot to choose from. The problem with this is not that you should never write a 5-paragraph essay. If you've got a short essay and you have 3 points, a 5-paragraph essay might be perfectly appropriate. In fact, if I didn't have the sub-arts here as writing process, this could be a 5-paragraph essay. It's that if it's the only pattern you have, there's no choice there. There's no exercise of a dunamis. All you have is banging out an essay. Right? Now they are fairly easy. They are fairly easy to grade if that's what you want, right? And that may be where it originates. And it does have some interesting features in that it probably is a good idea, as Aristotle would put it, to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. But I have had enough experience with you all to already know, and I've had a lot of experience with UD students to be absolutely confident in this, that you are extremely intelligent, distinct people. Does it seem likely that, regardless of the text, regardless of the topic, regardless of the situation, regardless of you as a distinct human person, one formula? No. It's a reduction. It's a complete reduction. So that was then, this is now. You obviously already know how to do it. Stop it. Right? You don't need to do that anymore. Instead, what you want to do is you want to attend to much, much more plural, inventive forms in order to be equal to the arguments that you're going to be developing. It's a faculty of discovering available means of persuasion. Where do you discover these? Well, you don't discover them in the abstract, because, of course, it's what's available to you. And so you have to attend to what's called the rhetorical situation. And the rhetorical situation is one in which you, as rhetor, have an audience. A subject, an end, and means of persuasion. Let me talk about this. The first resource here is you. Who are you? What resources of voice do you have in your written work? Do you have a good sense of humor? If you don't try. But if you do, it's worth calling upon. Who are you? You're the first variable in the rhetorical situation. And who you represent yourself to be, your ethos, is crucial. It's one of the really delightful experiences. I remember it distinctly as a young writer myself. I still enjoy it. Where you step forward as a version of yourself. In some ways, even truer to you than you are in your ordinary life. And you address an audience. And one of the things that's so wonderful about this is that you can actually elevate yourself because you're addressing a fairly elevated audience. Your audience is quite distinct in that they have actually set the writing circumstance for you. So you might be in philosophy and ethical life and you get your first essay assignment on the Republic. In the Republic, examine one of Socrates' definitions of justice and determine its strength or weakness. And you're writing for someone who may have taught the Republic a number of times. It's a little bit intimidating in some ways. This audience is quite distinct. The academic audience, and now I'm really talking about the professorial. I'm talking about writing for us. Just kind of delight in it, but also kind of fear, especially at the beginning. You have no idea what the expectations are. The first thing to say, these people are overeducated. We were in school way too long. And so there's a kind of desire for precision. There's a rich. There tends to be a rich background. So you find you think to yourself, I'm supposed to lead their soul? Really? That seems like a bit much, right? I'm 18. I don't really know what I'm doing. Guess what? Neither do we. I just said we're overeducated. I didn't say we know what we're doing. We're as lost as you are. Just a little older, so we've acquired some cunning, so it doesn't show. But the truth of the matter is, still an overeducated audience, no doubt about it. Demanding as all hell. But you shouldn't turn in work to a professor that isn't perfect. It should certainly be edited. You should certainly know how to use the apostrophe. If UD students don't know how to use the apostrophe, Western civilization might just as well close up shop. It's over. Time for the apocalypse. Bring it on. On your knees. The Lord is coming. Really? The apostrophe? You guys, you're the elite. You are. Write like it. So you are a rhetor addressing a demanding audience that is very interested in you. And the material. I am obsessed with the Iliad. I work in a department that is obsessed with the Iliad. And we are really, really interested in you. And what you think about the Iliad. We do. That's why we're here. We want to know what you think. We want to know what you think. So that can be intimidating. You think, I'd rather have the 5-paragraph essay, thank you very much. It only takes me 30 minutes. It's not quite so intense. And it doesn't tell me to await the apocalypse. True. It's also dull. And there's no real engagement. There's nothing at stake. Whereas this is something at stake. Now, the subject varies. There is, of course, an art of writing generally, but then there are arts of writing in specific disciplines. But we leave those, obviously, to other departments. We are teaching you the general art of writing with a slight prejudice, obviously, in favor of writing essays about literature. Your goal is to persuade us. The question then is, well, persuade you of what? So rhetoric, as opposed to sophistry, has as its end not mere persuasion, but persuasion as a proximate end in the service of a remote end, the remote end being truth. You're at a university that says in its opening statement of its mission statement, which is our constitution, right, that the primary and proper purpose of an education is the pursuit of wisdom, truth, and virtue. And the best essay in any set will actually lead one toward wisdom, including the apprehension of truth and probably some suggestion about how it might change how we act in the world. There's a lot at stake. If you're leading the soul of your reader to think in a certain way, to imagine in a certain way, and then to act accordingly, it's an extraordinary responsibility. So your end is persuasion directed toward the truth about the subject at hand. If you are making a case that the true hero of the Iliad is Hector, and you persuade me of that, that's going to influence my life. I'm going to think of my household duties, right, as a husband and as a father, as the most important things that there are. If, on the other hand, you persuade me to believe that Achilles is the true hero, I might actually decide, no, in fact, my most important duties are not as a householder, not as a husband and as a father, but instead as someone on the edge of the beach before the ocean, taking upon myself the reality of the entire cosmos. Those are two very different lives. Is it really just from reading my essay? Yes. Right, that's what's at stake. So the intensity that we bring to reading is the intensity that you should bring to writing, because of course it's the intensity of the core curriculum experience that we're all bringing to this magnificent curriculum that we've been given as a gift, which is what it is. We didn't invent it. Others who came before us did. And then you have to ask, what are the means that you will employ in order to persuade this particular audience to believe the truth of your thesis about the matter at hand? And that would be the art of rhetoric itself, which is composed of three sub-arts. Aristotle says that an art is the reasoned capacity to make. So you make essays, but you already know how to make essays by habit, no doubt about it. But making them by art means that it's the reasoned capacity to make, where you ask yourself, how shall I do this? What are my plans for this particular rhetorical situation? For example, there's a big difference between writing an essay where you agree with what you think the professor's argument is and writing an essay where you disagree. I mean, you may not have done that yet, but you will. At some point, you will say, you know, I think Professor X is simply mistaken about this text. And part of you will think, well, pretend otherwise. Don't tell them. Right? But then there's that other part of you, the heroic part of you, that will say, I need to persuade them that they are mistaken. That fascination that guy has with Achilles is a problem. He's gonna ruin his life. I've got to persuade him. Hector is the man. And Achilles is just a savage cannibal. Got to do it. That moment, which takes, by the way, not just compositional skill, it's going to take quite a bit, actually. It's going to take courage. It's going to take courage. So you have to begin to reason about what it is you plan on doing, what means of the art you will use. There are three sub-arts within that art. There are actually five, depending on which rhetorician you're meeting. Sometimes there are even six. The first is invention, the second is design or organization, and the third is style. And invention is the what? At a moment in the rhetoric, Aristotle says, state your case and prove it. I love his directness. I used to be bored by Aristotle, and now I just find these formulations really helpful. You state a case and you prove it. So you need a case. You might have more than one case. You might lead up toward a case, but there's got to be a point of some kind, and then you defend it. That's the what. But then the question is, okay, but in what order? And you say, I don't need to answer the question in what order, I know. Funnel in introduction, first point, second point, third point, funnel out conclusion. But you have more complicated arguments than that. You have invention that overflows that cookie cutter. A lot of you are going to be writing longer essays very, very quickly. Right? If you have an AMCIV paper that's 15 pages long, it's going to be pretty tough to use a 5-paragraph essay for. Why? That's going to be some long. Those are going to be some long paragraphs. It's just not going to work. So the question of in what order, and then style. How? So if you need a case and a defense and a beginning and a middle and an end, you also need words and sentences. And these three sub-arts constitute the art of writing understood rhetorically. There are two more. The fourth is the art of memory, and the fifth is the art of delivery. We don't tend to emphasize that, but there was actually a rhetorical art of memory where you could be trained how to remember things better. And then they also had an art for delivery, for actually speaking what you have written. We actually should do more on delivery, I think, myself. In fact, I've started to include more in my own classes. Instead of simply asking you what you think by written means, asking you to speak and to speak out. UD students tend to be highly articulate, but you all tend not to speak clearly or loudly or distinctly enough in class. It's not because I'm hard of hearing, I've actually been tested. Really. But it's because you tend to be too humble. I know it's a Christian virtue. I have a lot of respect for humility. Stop it. Because you deserve to speak and to be heard and to move people, but we don't tend to emphasize it. And I certainly won't be teaching you about it today. Instead, I want to concentrate on these three sub arts, and I'm actually going to go to the handout here for the rest of the outline. I'm trying to offer a comprehensive view of what composition is. But fortunately for me, although I have a limit in time, I also have a number of colleagues who are also going to be speaking to you during this series. And so if you'll notice, Professor Waterman Ward is going to be talking about parallel structure, which is a matter of style. And Ms. Niebuhr is going to be talking about ordering the cosmos of your paper, right, which is about design or organization. Concision, Mr. Spring will again be talking about style. Then we have beginning with the end in mind by Mr. Marchetti, who will also be talking about organization. Then we have one talk on the, I like the title here, the use and abuse of primary texts. We'll talk a little bit about that today. But Mr. Foreman is going to talk about supplying evidence, which is the one other talk directed pretty forcefully at invention. And then the series is going to end with Professor Romanek Baldwin actually talking about the whole again. And so what I'd like to point out is that I'm going to have very little today to say about design or style, because my colleagues are going to take those talks up. But what I'm noticing is that there's less on invention. So let me concentrate on that. I think that's how I could be of most use to you. So the first thing that happens is you get an assignment. And assignments come in usually two forms. Usually it's a topic that's given to you, and then you're just asked to respond to it. The other will come in the form of questions you're expected to answer. they always come, or they should, I think they always come, they always come with a scale. One to two pages, two to three, three to four, four to six, six to eight, 10 to 12, 12 to 15, 18 to 20, 25, you're at your senior year at this point, we're talking thesis now, but they come with a scale. And that scale is very important because you need to maintain it. Don't turn in an essay twice what was asked, the length of what was asked for. It won't be appreciated. It's a VIP move, right? It's everyone else deserves 3 to 4 pages. I, on the other hand, deserve 12 to 15 because I'm VIP, very important person. So don't break the rules. Stick with the scale. And the reason you want to stick to the scale is because your professor will actually give you a scale because there's a certain intellectual operation that he or she wants you to undertake, and that is, what can you do in a 2 to 3 page paper? That's not a lot of space. It seemed like it for essay one, but what you're going to notice is, those of you who are already writing essay two for your lit trad classes, 2 to 3 pages is not a lot of space. You have a lot to say. I know, because I've heard you on the Iliad. You have a lot to say. So what you have to do is you have to practice sharpening your focus. We often will give you a prompt that's not very focused at all. What is honor? Discuss. In 1 to 2 pages, discuss. Are we fated or are we free? 1 to 2 pages, discuss. That is insane. I mean, these are multi-volume topics, but you have to write very, very short essays. So there are two ways to sharpen the focus. One is to limit the text that you're going to write about, and another is to limit the topic you're going to write about. Preferably both. Pick an episode, pick a piece of an episode. Don't take up a whole topic, take up a subtopic. Don't take up freedom generally. Ask yourself, does the presence of physical force negate human freedom in relations between gods and men? What this does is it lets you then have a limit to what you have to do in the few pages that you have, which means then that it becomes possible to do. That you won't be talking at such a high level of generality as to not really be revealing much or anything at all. And then, at that point, you need to invent a thesis. And I want to talk about this because I've been really intrigued. I've done this myself quite a bit. In fact, I caught myself doing it and tried to stop. Where students will write essays without a thesis, and I'll ask, where's your thesis? And the tone is always, where's your thesis? How could you come without a thesis? You can't come to this without a thesis. We presume, I used to presume it myself, I'm doing it less so now, or I'm trying anyway, a reformed addict, and that is, it's a very hard thing to invent a thesis. It's a human accomplishment. It's rare, it's difficult. It really is. Why? Because a thesis is a proposition. You have to propose something. And notice, you're proposing in relationship to an assignment. So your rhetorical situation has been established. It's a proposition that actually has to go two different ways. It has to be determinate enough to be achievable. Given the scale at hand. It's not just any proposition, it's got to be a proposition you can actually make good on. You can actually persuade people to believe, given the scale that you have. But it also has to be broad enough to include all of your proofs. very common for students, especially when they're writing at the last minute. And you are going to do some last minute essays. You know, some of you, I think, have not done one yet. You're still pure, right? But there's going to come a time when you've got to bang out an essay. You just do. And what will happen is you'll write your introduction. You'll put down what you think is a thesis, which is really kind of a hunch, pretending to be a thesis. But you put it down. And then you'll write in defense of it, and then long about the second or third page, you'll start discovering something interesting. Much more interesting than what you thought you were going to be writing about. It's very, very common to happen because in fact writing is a process of discovery. We find a lot out while we're writing. And you find out, oh, this is what I'm really interested in, and then late into that second or third or fourth or fifth page, something really good arises, something original. Something where your reader thinks, oh, here we go. This looks like thought. Right? This is interesting. The problem for you is that you don't have a lot of time and you can't go back and revise. So basically what you do, well, you conclude, you hit spell check, and then you print the thing out, you get it in on time, boom, you're on to your next class's homework. The problem with that is that you're going to have an essay whose thesis actually doesn't include all of the proofs. It might actually only suit the first or the second. It's a dead giveaway, trade secret, dead giveaway. How to tell a banged out essay? Good stuff comes late and is not connected to what looked like a thesis early on. But of course, if you have a little time, even just a couple of hours, you can go back and you can revise the thesis to accommodate all of your proofs. Or it may be that what you discover is that's really where your argument was all along, and the earlier material was important for you to write, but nobody else needs to read it. So bad news, just cut it out. Right? It's just junk. You don't need it. You needed it, but your reader doesn't need it. These are tremendously, tremendously difficult to write. Again, a thesis is a human accomplishment. By the time you're seniors, you will do extraordinary, distinct work in your chosen discipline. It'll be quite amazing. In the spring, when people are presenting senior theses, go listen to them. It's amazing. If we filmed our seniors and put it on our website, we could ask, right? A professor? No, one of our seniors. I mean, people do amazing work. You all do amazing work eventually. Some of you are already doing some very strong work. But what I would say is, this is not easy. I've read a lot of professional work that either has no thesis or it also has hunches pretending to be theses. It's a very difficult thing to do. But when you do it, when you actually do distill something that you've discovered about the text, as you're persuading your reader to see it as well about, there's nothing quite like that. For a reader who's taking you, remember, very intensely and very seriously. What do you think about the text at hand? But of course, it's not enough to say it or to merely assert it. You need to prove it. And this takes the form of talking about both development and logic and evidence. I won't say as much about evidence. Because Mr. Forman will be talking about using and abusing, I presume defending the use of and critiquing the abuse of the text. But the first thing to point out is that you need to remember that your audience has already read the work. So you don't need to retell the story. So right away, a mere quotation is not necessarily evidence. I think that students very quickly will ask, do we need quotes? And then you'll ask one another, or you'll ask sophomores or juniors, do they like quotes? Do they need, are these people who like quotes? And then the boy went, oh, I heard you guys like quotes. You like quotes? You got quotes. Here's some quotes. yeah. And you go quote hunting, sort of favorite activity of all of us, by the way. I've gone quote hunting. I know what it's like. In fact, I've gone quote hunting recently. Flip, 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 looking for evidence. Flip, 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 flip. Ooh, there's a good one. Maybe yes, maybe no. One, don't retell the story. Two, don't quote in order to retell the story. In Homer's great epic, the Iliad, in Homer's great epic, Aphrodite is an important goddess, and then all of a sudden you start quoting material about Aphrodite, just as background. But maybe you only have 3 pages. Well, if you only have 3 pages, you do not want to spend precious time of evidence for evidence telling us what we already know. We've read Homer. You've read Homer. Your audience has read Homer. So whatever reminders you're giving us, they need to be brief. However, when you make a point, an important point, a central point, a point crucial to your thesis, you should cite text. And then you should connect the text to the point. First of all, this is a nice corrective technique, just in case your quotation doesn't actually prove your point. Sometimes what happens is we find a good quote, we put it in, and it's only when we try to connect the two that we realize, oh, you know, not only does this not pertain to what I'm saying, it actually disproves what I'm saying. And you'd be amazed how often this happens. I've had it happen in my own writing. It happens in student writing all the time. They'll say, oh, well, it's very apparent that argument A is true, and then there'll be a quotation that proves not A. It's really amazing, which makes you sound crazy. Makes me sound crazy when I do it too. You just think, what? A is not A? How did that happen? Because usually, first of all, many students don't cite text at all. It's just a download of opinion. But then a lot of you clearly already know to supply something like evidence. But you tend to stay away from this, which is too bad. Because when you go to connect the text to the point, and you really look at that passage closely, you will discover something new. Your point will take on a refinement. I would say the real originality in freshman papers tends to be right there. Where I'm reading, I don't know, you know, second or third thousandth essay on the Iliad. But I've never seen that passage quoted in quite that way before. And then the student will connect it to the point, and I'll see it in a whole new way. It's really amazing. Where all of a sudden it just lights up this passage. There's a lot of really fantastic invention that goes on right here. So I would say you definitely want to prove your cases by means of evidence. But connect the text to the point and explore. But prior to that, you need to develop your ideas. You need to defend your case. And I only have about 5 minutes, so I'm actually going to limit my discussion of development and logic. Go take a logic class as quickly as possible. I'm going to limit my discussion to definition. Because definitions are crucial to academic work, and they're really quite helpful. If you think that Homer thinks we're free, you need to define freedom. Otherwise, how do you measure whether or not we are? So my first point about development and logic would be define all central terms. Terms, by the way, central to your thesis. Terms central to your thesis. One point about that, don't use a dictionary. We're not talking about dictionary definitions here. We're talking about, instead, stipulative definitions where you say, right, for the purposes of this argument, freedom is meant in the strongest sense that one can do whatever he or she wants to do. Whether that's a good definition of freedom or not doesn't matter. The point is, for the purposes of this discussion, the purpose of this discussion is to indicate that if you're using significant terms in a thesis and then never defining them, then the target's always moving. Whereas as soon as you define and you stick to that definition, you do not equivocate, it's tremendously compelling, tremendously compelling. And I have been amazed in looking at textbooks, for example, just how central the topic of definition is to academic life. I've begun to think that it's the central proof, if you will, is to define terms. So you need to have a sharp focus. You need to have a thesis. You need to develop it and argue your case and not simply assume it, which is very common. And you need to provide evidence for it and explore the evidence by means of, under the aspect of, if you will, your case. Of course, you need to order it. Our other speakers will be talking about the art of design. You need to stylize it. Other speakers will be talking about style. Let me do two more things. One, you can use the subarts actually as a writing process. I'm only going to recommend this, but try it when you have time for one of your essays. Try this. Write an essay in which all you do is invent. That's all you do. You just come up with your ideas. Invent your thesis. Come up with your proofs. Don't worry about order. Don't worry about your sentences. Don't hit spell check. Be a little transgressive. Let the mistakenly spelled words go. Don't correct them. Leave your commas out. Go to town. Enjoy a little bit of life on the wild side. I know a comma goes there, but I don't have time for it because I'm inventing. Do that. Then arrange it. What do I need in my beginning? How shall I order the parts of my middle based on my case? How shall I conclude? Then go back and in a third draft, attend just to style, word choice, sentence structure, editing, including the apostrophe, please. You are the elite. Write like it. Try this just once. Just once. I think what you'll find is you end up producing really strong work. Let me conclude. I will stick around. I know that people have places to go and things to do at 4:00. I will stick around afterwards if you want to discuss anything that I have spoken of. Let me conclude. The soul leading that I'm talking about, rhetoric as a caring for the reader's soul, requires that the compositional arts that you learn of invention and organization and style participate in a human relationship between you and your reader. I only need about a minute. Don't clean up. I'll let you go. Just a minute. So the essay as made thing, then, is an intellectual, imaginative, even spiritual space for your reader to dwell in. For 15 minutes, 20 minutes, 30, 45, however long it takes to read. It is a world that your reader is in, and you made it. And it's a world we live in. It's a world we travel through on our way to find out what you think about these things that are so important not only to us but also to you. You are the soul leader in that moment, and we are the soul led. That moment is a writerly version of what the core curriculum essentially is. A community of people leading and being led in relationship to the most important and highest things. So writing is not only the least of what you're doing, it's a very high artistic form of the core experience itself. Thank you very much. Enjoy the other talks and good luck with your essays. Certainly.
I sent an email about the first essay.
I can reply to you tonight and I'll see you in a week or not.
You know, I want the next paper, I want it to be the perfect paper. I want it to go all out on it. And I did it the first time too, but I want to learn from what I did, the mistakes I made last time.
You'll be able to pick up your essay tomorrow and look at it over the weekend. You get started on the second and then bring me a draft on Tuesday.
Yeah.
Okay. And I can discuss it then.
So you can also draft the second one too?
I actually prefer to last. I'll write you about it, but I think it's better to talk about the second.
Yeah, that's great. So I can get your insight, then make some corrections, and then just turn around.
Okay. Is that perfect?
Thank you so much.
Oh, sure.
I'll see you next week. Thank you.
I'm glad to see you with the speaking because this is definitely very helpful. The question I had asked was I heard that in writing the theology of the body, John Paul II has a different sort of way of using speaking and arguing, because it's the Western way that sort of Plato and Aristotle made up. But he used sort of a different, more Eastern way, where you take a...
Eastern as Eastern Orthodox?
I don't think...
Or Eastern as
Eastern? It kind of from, I think it was from the tradition of more of the Jerusalem. At least that was my understanding of the word. I may have just interpreted it. So that where you take a central point, or a central idea, and you revisit it in a deeper depth.
Yeah, that's right. And that's a very interesting... First of all, the academic essay is only one kind of essay. So it's the one that everybody here is learning to write. But it's only one word. And the exploratory essay is another kind of all the and that kind of exploration, something more along the lines of Montaigne, for example. The Montaigne side of passage. Another point where you think he's only on the material that it turns out no, he's actually rebuilding the earlier. No, it's a very interesting technique. I hadn't thought about JP2's writings in that way. Now that you characterize the castle,
yeah, because I was reading, what was it? It was the book by Mary Healy, was it? Called Men and Women Are From Eden. It was kind of like a the theology of the body. And she said one of the things that he does is he'll take a passage, like he took the passage, I think, and they were naked and knew no shame, which is a really weird passage. And he does that process with them, and he discovers sort of what it means, like the new meanings about human sexuality from them.
That's right, and I think that's certainly the way to go. If one's own process was like that, my recommendation would be that one make sure, however, that it's patterned in such a way that the exploration has like episodes, so to speak,
okay,
definable parts,
leading toward the highest of the discoveries. Mm-hmm. Because the danger, especially for a young writer, the danger for the young writer is you go exploring, but it seems like you're lost. Mm-hmm. And so a reader can get impatient. So I think the exploratory is a wonderful genre. And in academic writing, I think there's a place for it, but it has to be disciplined, especially organizationally, mm-hmm. or it really taxes your organization.
Yeah. I mean, it's...
I.e. better than you.
Right. Yeah, I know. I mean, I think it does skill for it.
It can.
For like a longer work, like you know, when you start getting into that range of like 20, like you get a paper that's like, yes. it's approaching that length. It feels to me like, at least from what I've experienced, structure, like the like a kind of a sort of even sort of structure can get kind of unwieldy because your reader forgets where you were. So I think that sort of thing might be a little bit more effective depending on your topic.
No, I agree. That's where, I mean, what I would do is if we were fanning out to talk about writing, understood rhetorically, across a number of genres, not just the academic essay. I would say genre turns out to be one of your variables. So, but this is a highly limited, I mean, this series is to assist students in the writing of academic essays for classes. And so the idea is to circumscribe the discussion to one genre, but it's only one genre. And it may be not only more than others, it may be the most limited.
Maybe, because I mean, it gets the academic genre as a sort of progression from point A to point B to point C. When it's that you're at a starting point, I'm going to meet you at the starting point, and I'm going to guide you to point to my last point.
That's right.
That can be sort of tough.
It can, and I certainly think that there's a place for writing in this increasingly higher circular structure. I really admire writing like that, and I even written some pieces like that. What I would say is, academically, though, there's just no way around it. The dominant form of writing is highly logical, and so it really does proceed in logical progression. It's going to be really hard. What grade is
it? I'm a freshman.
You're a freshman. So it's going to be really hard to persuade, I think, some professors that you're going to find.
Okay.
That's why I think organizationally the decisions you make are so important to decide to write the exploratory essay. But I agree with you absolutely. The exploratory essay is a genre. It's very, very interesting.